Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm not alone. Here with me today, Erica Barnett, writing at thecisforcrank.com. Jossie Ross, local writer, attorney, activist. Matt Manweller, Republican representative, 13th District, Ellensburg area. I welcome you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming. Let's talk about what happened this week and why it matters. This is the time for you to shape the $50 billion transit project that will change the way you move around the Puget Sound area. The public comment period ends next week. The Sound Transit Plan would cost the average household about $400 more per year in new taxes, none of which will be paid by Matt Manweller because he lives in Ellensburg. Matt, you think Sound Transit supporters are deluded, thinking we are densely packed enough for light rail?
Well, I don't know if they're deluded. I mean, I think that if people want to tax themselves for a project, they have every right to do so, as long as they're not taxing somebody else, and that's fine. They're not asking for state money.
Yeah, we have
they're
the
asking
right.
For your own local money. But, I mean, I think that the problem we have in the West is that we sometimes try to model mass transit off of cities that are far more compact in the East. And, you know, if you look at the Sound Transit Plan, it runs from Everett to Tacoma. If you go back east, you can cross three state lines in the amount of distance it takes to go from Everett to Tacoma. So sometimes what you run into is these problems where you try to take a mass transit system that was developed, you know, in these very compact cities in the East, and you try to replicate them in the West where the footprint is much larger, and you just get people angry because no matter how well you design it, you can't put a stop in everybody's neighborhood. Somebody feels left out. So to kind of pacify those complaints, you put a stop, or you try to put a stop everywhere, and then the next thing you know, you have a $50 billion price tag. So I just think that it's a little bit more problematic to create mass transit systems in larger footprint Western cities than it is back east. But, you know, Portland has done it, and it can be done. But, you know, $50 billion is a lot of money that will crowd out taxation capacity for other social services that are equally important. So it's just something you got to think about when you spend $50 billion.
Erica, too big, too expensive, we're too spread out, right?
I disagree with all three of those. I think there are lots of models that are not on the East Coast for mass transit systems, obviously. I mean, there's Houston, there's LA, there's San Francisco, there's Portland, there's Denver. You know, and I don't think it's too big. I think it is ambitious, and it's ambitious in the way that it needs to be. It's a regional system. That's by design. That's the system that we agreed to. So building out to the suburbs, you know, people in Seattle actually are not super thrilled about that. Some people, because, you know, it's going to be really slow to get to Ballard, but it is a regional system. And I think building out to like Snohomish County, which has been faithfully voting for Sound Transit over and over again, they've gotten one bus so far out of the deal. Building down to Tacoma, building out the system on the east side is a really, you know, it's a good strategy because we need the tax money and it's a regional system. So and I think that taxpayers have consistently supported it, and I expect that they will this time, too.
Jossie, you're not paying for this either, are you?
Yeah, actually, I have residences in West Seattle.
Okay.
But aside from that, I think that, you know, with all due respect to my Republican brethren in the House, and, you know, I'm an independent. I don't swing one way or another in regards to political partisanship. But I think that oftentimes these are couched in the wrong terms. And they're couched in terms of transportation as opposed to something that affects profoundly the environment. And prophylactically, looking forward, prospectively, I think it's important that we say that, you know, Democrats right now are doing a decent job, decent. And I try to be just as critical of Democrats as Republicans, of looking prospectively of what the problems are going to be in 50 years, as opposed to right now. So what Matt says might be absolutely true at this moment regarding density, but I think that's the wrong calculus. And I think with these dollars, since we are oftentimes borrowing against the future, it's important to also consider the ramifications for the future. And in this project, both on a transportation level, but also in regards to the impact on the environment. Just having less people on the highways, to me, as somebody who drives I-5 frequently, is a good thing.
Matt, we should be thinking to the future, and we do have this climate change problem, whether we wish it or not. What do you say to those arguments?
Well, I mean, I think that you're going to ask yourself, you know, a lot of times when you have these mass transit systems, they can't pay for themselves because they can't generate enough voluntary users. So you end up subsidizing them. So I don't think the $50 billion price tag even begins to scratch the surface, because at the end of the day, the ridership probably won't cover the maintenance costs of the program. Why is that? Because, you know, if you get on a mass transit system and you end up in Tacoma, it's not like Tacoma is a little tiny town that you can walk across. You still need a car when you're down in Tacoma. So sometimes we in the central planning business try to create a system based on the way we want people to behave rather than the way they actually behave. And that is always a process for failure. And we look at this ridiculousness of the floating bridge, where we spend billions of dollars to rebuild a bridge and we don't add any capacity because the central planners don't want there to be any capacity, because by building a skinny bridge, more people are going to ride their bike to Seattle. Well, we can't build systems based on the way we want people to behave. You got to build systems based on the way people actually behave.
I think that's a really depressing and short-sighted view of planning. I think planners do need to look out 50 years at how people are going to be behaving. And I think in some ways, Sound Transit is doing a really good job of that, because they're saying people are going to be living more densely, and they're going to be living more densely in the suburbs as well. So when you're looking at Issaquah, I mean, they've already massively densified. If you're looking at Kent, they've upzoned dramatically. If you're looking at Redmond, they've upzoned quite a lot, too. And they're doing that because that's the way that people are going to be living. I mean, every decision we make on, you know, whether we're going to widen a highway or whether we're going to narrow a highway or whether we're going to build a mass transit system is social engineering. So building a wider 520, that would have been social engineering, encouraging people to drive more cars, and it has that result. So, you know, I just think the idea that we shouldn't look 50 years out and think of how people are going to be traveling is really bad planning.
Let's end with an alternative that we could react to. Matt Manweller, what's your better idea? We do have more and more people coming. How do we move us around?
I mean, the mass transit system isn't necessarily a bad idea. I mean, I think I look at as a student of political economy, I look at a $50 billion plan that takes 25 years to implement. That's not a plan to bring mass transit to Seattle. That's a plan of job security for the Sound Transit Board and, you know, the bureaucrats who work for Sound Transit.
What's your plan?
Eisenhower built the entire interstate highway system in less time and about the same amount of money. So my plan would be to model what we did when the bridge fell down on the I-5, right? You know, that bridge went down on I-5 and people said, that bridge can't be replaced in 6 months.
You mean in Skagit County?
Yeah, it needs to be replaced now. So what did the governor do? He goes, we're going to come in and we're going to waive all the silly, burdensome, duplicative rules that we have. They got that bridge up in a month. They didn't kill a single fish. They didn't kill any riparian zones. So what if we took that approach to Sound Transit and you built it in 12 years for $25 billion?
What's right? The it? What are we building? What system do you want?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't live over here. You know, if you guys want to go all the way out to Tacoma or Everett, I guess it's your dime. So,
but just less regulation.
Yeah. Why do we need to spend $5 billion and do 10 years doing environmental impact studies and hiring expensive consultants? It's a bad law. And when we waived it, when the bridge fell down, we got the bridge put up at half the cost and half the time, and we didn't kill a single fish. So we've shown we can do it. Why don't we?
To remind listeners, that's Matt Manweller, Republican representative. He's in Ellensburg. Jossie, quick reaction before we wrap up here.
Yeah, I think generally eschewing federal laws is a bad idea. And I think that those laws, specifically, you know, here in the West, we tend to be cognizant of those things that are environmental regulations. And I think it's for a reason. We have a track record of trying to do something that's somewhat harmonious. I mean, granted, there's development. But, you know, we do things that are tries to be cognizant of the earth. As a matter of empirical anecdotal fact, people are having sex. There are babies being born. There's a lot of people that are coming.
Can we confirm that? Let me check. No, check the news department.
You know, we got to make sure.
We're going to try to.
And so with that, we have to find some solutions and to think prospectively about how and hopefully try to engineer some of that behavior in the future. I think to think otherwise that we shouldn't do that and to just let people live as they have always lived. Well, that's not really going to work in a community that's densifying frequently.
Erica, finally, called that freedom, by the way.
Freedom. Okay. Yeah. Erica, finally.
Well, I think that, you know, the suburbs are densifying, and that's going to happen regardless. I think the only thing we should be changing about the plan is we should build less parking. There's $660 million going toward parking garages with thousands of stalls. I actually think that's going to become less necessary in 50 years than it is today.
We're going to focus on that. We're going to do some coverage just on the idea of parking. Where is it headed? How much of it is worth building at what cost right now? So, good. This is the Week in Review, and coming up, when you go to your ATM machine, who should be looking back at you? I'm with Jossie Ross, Erica C. Barnett, Matt Menweller, and you're here too, because we're live tweeting the show. We're at KUOW. What do you think? You should be a radio producer, Matt, because I didn't say, when are we going to be talking about currency, about Harriet Tubman? That's going to be at 12:26, about 10 minutes from now.
Great.
Thank you for that. What should we talk about now? How about public drinking? Hey. Because this week, a Seattle advisory board said, we have a problem. Okay, we have a problem. Giving people citations for drinking in public is not working. It's not stopping them from drinking. It's not getting them help. And it's not even fair, because people who have a home can do anything they want inside. So this is hitting poor people, especially African Americans and Native Americans. So Seattle's Community Police Commission says the city should set up designated areas where people can drink without getting cited for it. Jossie, should Seattle create these outdoor drinking spaces?
Well, as you heard, Erica and I were having a invigorating conversation before we actually went on the air. And she makes a very good point that these aren't either or questions necessarily, right? That this doesn't necessitate that police should not stop, you know, that they shouldn't disparately point out and arrest, or excuse me, give citations to Native Americans and African Americans. But I think that history shows that when municipality, a county, a state, or a country does prophylactic steps that says we're going to take this proactive measure to try to alleviate disparate enforcement of a particular provision, that a lot of times that has equated to absolution, like this is the solution. And we're checking off that box. We did this thing that was done in the name of civil rights or human rights on behalf of Native Americans or African Americans. And I think that that's a dangerous thing here.
By the way, you're a Native American yourself.
I am. I'm fairly Native American, yeah. But the problem here ultimately underlying is about selective enforcement of laws. It's not about public consumption. It's not about whether or not it should be a BYOB spot or beer gardens or anything like that. It's about, why are you enforcing differently down in Seward Park or Genesee Park when people are barbecuing versus at Steinbrook Park where the Native Brothers are drinking at? That's a fair question. And I think that we have to keep sight of that question. So if, in fact, this does go through, cool, there's public spaces. But that doesn't take away the onus or the burden from continuing to ask that question. Why is there disparate enforcement?
Well, I'm going to throw out an alternative idea, two alternative ideas. Right now at City Hall, I believe there's an action for public consumption spaces, not just for heroin, which is being discussed, a safe injection site, but for all types of drugs that people are already consuming in public. And I think alcohol is one of those drugs that is going to be consumed in public no matter what. So that's one idea is, you know, maybe we make public safe consumption spaces for all drugs that people are using anyway. Another idea is, you know, why don't we just make drinking in public legal?
Did you see the reaction from your Republican brother over there?
I think he's agreeing with
me. Republican brother with a libertarian heart.
Okay, go on.
When we concentrate things in certain areas, for one thing, neighbors get upset. And I can see that this is going to be a huge deal. Particularly, you know, I mean, you talked about Steinbrook Park, but there's areas in neighborhoods like Ballard. Everybody's all exercised about the Commons Park up there. And I can see, you know, the city saying, well, let's just make the Ballard Commons Park a drinking area, a free for all for everybody who is, you know, does not have a house to go drink. I think that causes, unintended but obvious consequences. So why not just make it legal everywhere? And I think the same thing goes for pot. I mean, it's, you know, and I'm you know, this is not a policy prescription because I have not, you know, thought through every single ramification of this. It just seems like a better idea to try than what we're doing now, and better than concentrating people into little, you know, carols.
So this is Las Vegas, right, Matt?
No, I don't think it's Las Vegas. So I would agree with Erica 100%, at least with respect to alcohol. There's no real reason to criminalize the consumption of a legal beverage outside of your home or outside of an establishment. Who is harmed if I drink my beer on the curb instead of on my porch? Who is harmed if my wife and I grab a glass of wine and walk down to the docks and watch the sunset, you know, go down? I mean, it's... I mean, do we have this rampant problem where my wife and I are secretly sneaking Chardonnay glasses to eight-year-olds? No. I mean, it's just an absurd thing.
So you're calling for the legalization now of all drugs. Can I put you on the record?
I'm not. Yeah, what I'm saying is that if something is already legal, like a beer or a glass of wine or a vodka tonic, who cares if I have a beer at the park when I'm having a barbecue? I mean—
Did you vote for legal marijuana?
I'm not going to tell you. yeah, I did. I absolutely voted for 502. But my point is that Washington State, despite being this very, you know, populous state, has very draconian liquor laws when it comes to the rest of the country. I travel all over this country and I'll ask these questions like, hey, can I take my beer outside? And they look at me like I'm crazy for even asking. And like, of course you can, right? What's the problem, right? Well, in my state, every time we sell beer, we put up a Guantanamo Bay-like chain fence and we shame them. Ooh, the beer drinkers are behind the steel fence, you know, and we put a security guard up. You can't walk out here with the normal people. You have a beer in your hand. What do you think I'm going to do with the beer? Go force it down a priest's throat? I mean, for the love of God, you know.
Would you? So you would not do that?
No, right? I promise I won't. I'd ask him if he wanted a sip, but I just think what you do is you maintain the laws that are side effects of drinking. Should public drunkenness still be prohibited? Sure. Should littering?
How do you know if somebody's drunk? You mean disorderly conduct is prohibited?
Absolutely. You know, disorderly conduct is prohibited. You can't throw your can down. You don't litter, right? But you can't give it to a minor. But those are laws that already exist. And I would go back to what Jossie said, is that when you over-criminalize human behavior, you provide opportunities for a police state to take advantage of it. The young man that was killed in New York was shot by police, and it was because he was selling a loose cigarette. And it turned out that there was a law against selling a single cigarette. So that gave the police the right to stop him, which led to his shooting. If the state legislature hadn't criminalized handing out a single cigarette, the kid never would have been shot.
So Matt and Erica are on board with open consumption. What about you, Jossie?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I think that we've largely taken the bumpers out of the bowling alley in regards to a lot of substances here. And as Matt pointed out, these are legal substances. Now, we can talk about the morality, whether that was good in the first place or not. But the fact is that they are available on the market, and I don't see the regulatory structure being, there's any really compelling reason for having these. Just they're just weird. I mean, at some level, like it might be draconian, but just weird.
Does anyone drawing the line where? Because you could say this about heroin is widely used, too.
I don't think I want to go to the park with my six-year-old son while somebody's sticking a needle in their arm.
Just to clarify, I wasn't saying that. They're talking about doing safe injection sites, and one of the reasons for that is that you can do harm reduction and people don't OD.
And that's probably a different argument.
Yeah, and that's a different...
letting people shoot up.
Exactly.
People drink themselves to death, you're aware.
They do, and like I said, heroin's not legal. Beer and wine is. If you are sitting there and you're drinking to the point where you're stooping over and you're puking in the streets, then yeah, I think a police officer should say that's public drunkenness. But if somebody who is 21 years of age is drinking appropriately at a park, there is no crime being committed here. There is no harm being committed on a third party. There's no, as long as they don't throw the can on the ground, leave them alone.
We're going to leave the subject, but just Jossie, because you look the most troubled, I want to make sure you get the last word.
Yeah, it's just, going to Matt, I mean, now what he's saying is sounding a little bit like selective enforcement. And I think that, no, I understand. And I'm cool. So you asked the question, Bill, whether or not I'm cool with, making it legal across the board. Absolutely. But then I think that we have to, be very mindful still of that enforcement part, because irrespective of whether or not that particular law regarding public consumption is there, then the public drunkenness becomes a selective enforcement thing, right? Now we're enforcing at Steinbrook Park in numbers disparate to Stewart Park or Seward Park or Genesee Park. And we always have to be careful and question that underlying thing of why people who look like me with brown skin are criminalized more often than people who don't. And I think that that's the bigger question out of this question.
We've been talking about, thank you, Jossie Ross, Erica C. Barnett, Matt Manweller, talking about this community police commission. It's not the police department. It's not the city council yet. It's an independent advisory board saying the city ought to set up designated areas where people can drink without getting cited. And we are also talking about safe consumption sites for other drugs as well in the city. We'd love to hear what you think. There's so much more to say about this. We are at KUOW live tweeting the show right now, and we're going to be back talking about a few more things that happened this week, including, do we have a democratic system in this state and in this country? Stay tuned.
Bill, now that you guys have solved the issue of open drinking in public, what about open drinking in public radio?
Open drinking in public radio. That's an interesting question.
Maybe next week?
Maybe that's we have to report that out. Thank you, Bernard. We're on it. Your money gets a makeover. You're listening to The Week in Review, and this week the Treasury Department released a plan for new currency. Let us begin with the $20 bill. Andrew Jackson, president, slave trader, and Indian killer, moves to the back, and the abolitionist, Harriet Tubman, will be on the front. Good idea, Matt?
Well, I mean, I think that countries traditionally update their currency from time to time. You know, I think that the best way, you know, you do that is – you try to promote somebody without trying to tear somebody else down. I think that that's the best way to evolve with your culture and the symbols of the institutions of your culture. We have a tendency, I think, in our current political culture that it's not enough to win, but it's really important to demonize the other side. And so you can't just beat your political opponent. You have to destroy them personally as well.
Is Andrew Jackson being personally destroyed?
I think that they've actually done a pretty good job here. Rather than kind of saying you're out completely, we're going to keep you on the 20, but we're going to share it with another thing. I like the idea that they didn't say, you know, we're going to punish this guy because he did things that we don't like. We're going to say you're going to share some space with somebody who's done things that we do like. The only thing else I would throw out about this issue is that, you know, I'm uncomfortable with one unelected official kind of making these decisions. I think that this should probably be a vote of Congress because those are our representatives. And, you know, Lou has never had his name on a ballot. And, you know,
this is
and
the Treasury Secretary.
Right. So, I mean, I just think that this should probably be something of congressional action rather than an unelected bureaucrat making that decision.
But you're good with Harriet Tubman on one side, Andrew Jackson on the other.
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
Well, I think throwing it to Congress means that it would never, ever, ever happen. You know, countries other than the U.S. aren't so fussy about their money, and they don't, you know, they change currency all the time. And, you know, I think I kind of went back and forth on this topic because there is a really good argument about, you know, putting Harriet Tubman on the money, you know, goes against everything she believed in. She was, you know, an enslaved person who, you know, was enslaved because of money, and being put on the, you know, on the symbol of capitalism is kind of inappropriate. On the other hand, I found this Washington Post piece really convincing, which said, you know, look, this is putting a black person, a minority, a person of color on cash, which is the currency most used by people of color and by people who don't have access to credit, you know, who are, you know, it's a civil rights issue. Access to cash is a civil rights issue. And so it's appropriate. Now, leaving Andrew Jackson on the back, I don't know. I think that his feelings won't be hurt if he's taken off the money. And I don't see any reason. I think you can make a really good case against having him on any of our money and not worry about hurting people's feelings because, you know, ultimately, as you said, the guy was a slave trader and killed Native Americans and, you know, is, in my opinion, an all around pretty bad dude. So let's take him off the money. Why does he need to be still represented?
Jossie.
I think it's OK to demonize people who mass killed other people. As a matter of historical fact, Andrew Jackson was singularly responsible for the Trail of Tears, which killed thousands of Native people. Thousands. He was singularly responsible. Justice John Marshall made a determination that the Cherokee could stay in Georgia, but him, in his righteous, white, supremacist, patriarchal monstrosity, said, Justice Marshall made his determination. Now let him enforce it. He is singularly responsible for that. And I have no problem with demonizing Pol Pot. I have no problem with demonizing Hitler. And I certainly have no problem with demonizing Andrew Jackson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And so, no, it's an absolutely horrible compromise to have this righteous, amazing, revolutionary black woman on the flip side of everything that she stood against is this reprehensible white man who stood for values of a time long ago that hopefully we still do not want to honor. I'm not sure if Matt wants to honor that, but I think it's a horrible thing. Now, I think it's good to have this symbol that we value, which is money, that has a black woman, specifically a black matriarch on it. That's powerful because, rightly or wrongly, we do value money. And that's how we show what we value in this economy. Yet it is dangerous, I think, to show these two mixed messages on the same bill that people do value today.
Well, I'd have two things I'd say to respond to that. And that is, one, there's one thing about Andrew Jackson that I absolutely do want to honor. And Andrew Jackson represents the first common man to be elected as president of the United States. Up until Andrew Jackson's election, the presidency was monopolized by elite, large plantation owner Virginians other than Adams. And Jackson's elections broke that monopoly and said, look, the common man can rise up and be president. We actually refer to Jacksonian democracy because of that. And that's a very quintessential American thing, whether you're talking about Harry S. Truman being just a cobbler who becomes president, or Barack Obama, who's a community organizer but rises to become president. So there is something very American about what Jackson represents.
But we don't enshrine every president or everyone who has something good to say about them. Why you still need to make the case that Andrew Jackson, for all we've just heard, belongs on our currency.
Well, I mean, Jackson's presidency represents opening up the political process to the common person rather than just this small body of elites.
But here, why doesn't the genocide drown out those?
I guess, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to defend Andrew Jackson's actions towards Native Americans, but I would caution us, right, is that we go down a very dangerous path when we want to subject people from 200 years ago to our current standards, right? Let me give you a little story and then I'll hand it off. The students at the University of Oregon 2 months ago led a protest to take down Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. It is written on the wall at the University of Oregon in the Student Union building. And the argument is that Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech was not inclusive enough about people who suffer from gender dysphoria. And therefore, Martin Luther King was an exclusionary person. And I mean, so you're going to take this 2020-ish morality and impose it to a civil rights leader in the 1950s and say, you're no longer good enough, so we're going to take your speech down. We run a risk when we look backwards and say, you should be judged according to our moral standards, because can anybody live up to it?
Well, I was gonna pivot a little bit.
If you're not gonna pivot, Jossie, do you want to before we pivot?
I'm
you want to just
pivot.
Respond directly to
no,
that?
No pivoting at all. That's silly, and I'll tell you why.
It is silly.
The reason why is because that's not a 2020 morality. That was an 1820s, 1830s morality. The only people who defended that morality were white men like yourself. Black people, I'm sure, did not have that same morality that said, this is okay. Slavery was an institution that lasted from 1620 to 1865, 245 years. And during that time, abolitionist movement started in the 1830s. But I assure you, And this is a matter of historical record, but also a matter of conjecture, that there were black folks who opposed slavery during that whole time. When we have this extremely white patriarchal view that the only people that create this morality that the United States subscribes to is white men, of course you're going to have that opinion that this is 2020 morality. But absolutely, people have opposed slavery for a long time and understood that it was a crime.
But under that logic, Jefferson should come off, Washington
absolutely.
Should come
Take
off.
Them off.
Right,
can,
yeah, well,
can I
there
just
you go.
Can I just add a suggestion?
Radicalism.
You know, one of the things that happened that led to the story about the $20 bill is that it was going to be Harriet Tubman was going to be on the $10 bill. Now that's being pushed off, and she's going to be on the $20 bill at some later date, assuming that, you know, this continues to go forward. I agree with Jesse. I mean, why don't we get some of these guys off the bills? And frankly, I think Harriet Tubman is one woman, and one woman is not enough.
Yes.
When Ruth Bader Ginsburg was asked, you know, when will there be enough women on the Supreme Court? She said, when there are nine. And I don't think that, you know, that we just have to stop here and say, okay, you know, we got our woman and we got our person of color, so we're done. And I think once we start, you know, mixing it up a little bit, you know, we can make some people who want to defend Jefferson, people who want to defend Washington can make their cases. I think the Andrew Jackson case is pretty clear. And I would not say that I think comparing him to Martin Luther King is an insult.
That's not
and,
what I was doing. But
well,
I'm
even making the analogy, it's not
so
a correct analogy.
Do you think the kids
analogy.
At UW are right? Should Martin Luther King's speech come down at the University of Oregon?
I don't agree with that. No,
okay, absolutely. Because
but
crazy.
I don't think they're comparable.
It's crazy.
Either. I don't think they're comparable either.
Okay, so, Matt, money can be fluid. Mm-hmm. And these dead white presidents are in any decent textbook, hopefully in the fullness of their accomplishments and their atrocities. Right. That's what history books are for.
Right.
Lots of countries. There are countries with art on their money. There are countries with landmarks on their money. Right. Why enshrine in that way?
Why? Well,
based on everything we've just heard over the last few
months. Most currencies in the world choose the, you know, famous queens or Queen Elizabeth's on the British money. You know, we've chosen to do presidents. There's nothing wrong with that. We just have this kind of rampant PCism that we're going through right now. We go through these bouts every few generations where let's take Jefferson and Washington and let's demonize them, you know, because they weren't perfect.
Or taking them off the money is not the same as demonizing them in every aspect of their lives.
He's the first president of the United States. We're talking about the author of the Declaration of Independence. We're talking about men who took the ideas of the Enlightenment that were written by John Locke and actually put them into practice for the first time in the world.
And who also allowed slaves.
Okay,
one could argue that
get over it.
Did you just say get over it? And that's something that have you gotten over 9/11?
You know what? I'll tell you.
I ask you a specific question.
I'm not going to go around and demonizing all Muslims because I'm not over 9/11.
No, but have you gotten over it, though?
I guess I've gotten over it in the sense, I mean, that it doesn't.
You're disclaiming. The answer is no. In the same way that it's completely unfair, inappropriate in your white maleness to tell people that have
white
been.
Maleness, right?
Absolutely. That have been profoundly affected by the effects of slavery. By the effects of genocide, there were less than 250,000 Native people in this country at the 20th century. That's the direct result of that thought process that you're exhibiting right now. So, no, we can't get over it because it still has impact today, Matt.
Okay. Because now we're talking to one another in a room, I just want to make sure that we remember all the listeners who are listening who we really want to talk to and also sort of walk through all these issues together with, because sometimes I've heard when people get angry at one another, and then it's, you know, you and you, our listeners feel sort of nervous, for one thing, you know, our people are fighting. I want to learn. I want to hear all this discussion we've had.
Yes.
I think it's fantastic. Whoever you agree or disagree with, I just kind of want to put in to remind us all that we're talking with listeners who we want to include in the conversation, and that it's not, it may seem to listeners like right now this is about people being really mad at each other, and it's not. We're talking about important issues and where should we all go from here.
Can I just make a point that you know, it isn't, you know, whether you agree that Andrew Jackson should be demonized or think that that's, you know, that demonizing is terrible. I don't think it's demonizing somebody to take them off the bill. I think it's saying, you know, we have deified these people. And, you know, in our history books, there is not a true story of what happened from every perspective. And so maybe putting some other voices or some other perspectives on our currency and in our history books is a way of correcting the deification of people like Andrew Jackson and like Jefferson and like Washington. You don't have to think of it as demonizing.
But I will.
No, we're not going to talk until we reach a complete agreement. We're gonna pause there and talk about some other things that happened this week on the Week in Review with Erica C. Barnett and Jossie Ross and Matt Manweller. Thanks for hanging in with us. We're going to talk about democracy and maybe why someone in this room is wearing a purple sweater. Stay tuned. You're right, not just purple, but there's paisley in the room as well. The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. The dominant high school football program in our state is in trouble. Accused of facilitating a diploma mill in a little private school tucked inside a Bellevue office park.
Boosters paid for athletes to attend this alternative private school, that coaches were encouraging players to go to this private school, that false addresses were used to help players gain eligibility.
That was Seattle Times reporter Mike Baker on KUOW this week. The Bellevue head coach says the investigation is biased against the football program. Matt, you've been a high school teacher. Why do these accusations not surprise you at all?
Well, you know, I've taught in all types of school, rural schools or urban schools, and you know, I've seen it. You know, a great kid all of a sudden transfers into the district who just happens to be the star pitcher or a great quarterback. This stuff has been going on for a long time, and it doesn't surprise me. It generally happens in wealthy school districts. You know, poor school districts can't afford to do this stuff. They're usually the ones that have their kids poached, but was absolutely not surprising to me that a very wealthy area in the state was able to, you know, kind of figure out a way to use their financial resources to recruit, and I'll put that in quotes even though we're on the radio, recruit top-notch high school players. I don't like it. The idea of high school athletics is supposed to be fairness. We segregate you based on school size so that it's even. But if one school can kind of game the system, then I think they should have been investigated. And if they broke the rules, then I think they should be suspended from, qualifying for championships. I don't think you should suspend them from playing because then you're just punishing the kids for something the coaches and the parents did. But I think that they absolutely should be investigated for this type of behavior.
So even though it happens all the time, it's fair to have targeted Bellevue?
Well, I don't know if they were just targeted. I mean, like all laws, I mean,
I shouldn't say targeted, but to have investigated.
People break them,
Bellevue.
And if you find out information about one person, you get investigated, and if you don't find out, you don't. But I don't know if there was any vindictiveness there.
No.
I don't have any information either way.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that. Yeah. Jossie, does this seem fair?
Specifically regarding Bellevue, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't know if Bellevue really plays the victim card well. I'm not sure. And moreover, as Matt said, you know, there is a difference between punishing the kids, because the kids oftentimes are the products of manipulation in this. They don't really have a lot. A lot of times, honestly, the kids are trying to go to a better school. And we should congratulate that. Now, if they go for different reasons, for athletic reasons, obviously that's against the rules. But I'm not so opposed to the notion of kids trying to find a better education someplace else. We have schools. Not all schools are created equally. We realize that. Not all schools are created equally. And I'm fine with parents and kids conspiring through whatever means to, I'm going to go to this great school that offers a great science program. And I don't think that athletics are outside of that realm to say we're looking for this better program. However, as a matter of fact, similar to the EPA laws that Matt was talking about earlier, it is against the law currently. And so in that regard, I can't say it's unfair, because until that's opened up, this process of recruiting is opened up to everybody, of course it's unfair for one school or two schools to unjustly be enriched constantly from a talented pool that other schools don't have access to.
Well, no one would begrudge a student moving into a different district to get into a better science program, but are we in this strange situation where we have to pretend that we're not doing what we're really doing when we say it's all about scholastics or sports are all about fair play?
Well, I think in this case, if I understand correctly from the stories that Mike Baker wrote in Seattle Times about this, a lot of these kids were being put through a diploma mill in a strip mall in Bellevue where, you know, they didn't have to show up to class and they could, you know, use their notes during tests. And it really wasn't, you know, getting a better academic opportunity. Mm-hmm. So I think this is exploitation of these kids and their families. And, you know, I get the response that it's racist, that, you know, that they're targeting these kids. But I really think what's being targeted is an athletic program where, you know, we put football on such a high pedestal, apparently, that, you know, that schools are willing to, and boosters are willing to cheat, and parents are willing to cheat to get kids into, you know, ostensibly into a school district where, you know, where they can't afford to live.
So that magnet, the fact that we apparently love football that much and other sports that much, given that,
yeah,
Matt, high school coach, and you're at Central Washington teaching, what can we do given that attraction?
I don't want to come across as anti-athletics because as a high school teacher, I have seen kids who probably would not have made it academically if it wasn't for the fact that they needed to get C's to stay on the wrestling team. Mm-hmm. It gave them discipline. It gave them a role model. It pulled them off the streets. I love high school athletics. But when we as parents start elevating athletics so high that it says, hey, the parents are telling you it's okay to game the rules, it's okay to cheat, it's okay to do things that aren't fair. We wonder why we have the Johnny Manziels of the world. There is a kid who probably adults made excuses for him his entire life, and now look what we've created, right? Whether it's a Ryan Leaf or a Johnny Manziel or a Paris Hilton, when the adults say, this athletics is so important that we're saying it's okay to not get a legitimate diploma, to cheat on the rules, then of course we're going to have products that look like Johnny Manziel. So athletics is great, but when adults elevate it so high that we corrupt the kids, then it's a bad thing.
Okay, so a couple of minutes ago, we were talking about designated drinking spaces, and you said, lift the rules, just let people drink. So similarly, is the answer here to just take academics out of sports, quit pretending they're the same thing, and then you don't have the fakery and the diploma mills, and you just play if you want to play.
No, because I don't like that idea. I mean, when you come to a college, it's there to get a degree. I know a lot of people, I'm sure you have something to add to this, is that, you know, you're there to get a bachelor's or something, and you're there to educate.
Unless you're not, in which case, why don't you just play and okay, why don't
then,
you
then
study?
Let's go into the minor leagues. Create a minor league system for it. But
that's
at the
I'm
end
asking.
Of the day, you know, education should be first and sports should be second, not the other way around.
But they're entwined now.
I think this speaks to our need for public school financing equalization.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, fundamentally, what you're talking about is, you know, is they don't, you know, Bellevue doesn't necessarily want to be a place where it's affordable to, you know, to people of color to move in, and to, you know, the kids that they want on their football teams to move in. And Bellevue has a disproportionate ability to pay for a really good school.
That's right.
So the problem is our school system. And I mean, you want to talk about, you know, root causes and putting Band-Aids on things. I think loosening up the rules to make it easier for kids to play on teams at schools they don't go to as a Band-Aid that doesn't address the root cause, which is that we have a fundamentally unfair school funding system in the state.
I agree with Erica 100%. And it is a Band-Aid. I mean, but part of it is that I understand that this has gone on for a long time. I mean, just, you know, having played sports myself, I've seen it a million times. People transfer and then people, oh, well, I wonder how they got there. No, we really know how they got there. You know, it was for a specific reason. I agree with Erica 100%. I just don't know if Mercer Island and Bainbridge Island and these school districts that are, you know, really, really heavily moneyed are planning on giving up their, you know, their throne and distributing that wealth anyplace else anytime soon. I mean, I would absolutely vote for that. I'll pay more in taxes. But I think that outside of that conclusion, and I absolutely, Erica pointed out that we could work toward two outcomes, positive outcomes at the same time. And that's right in regards to public intoxication. In regards to this, we can work toward that. But I also think that it is dangerous, number one, to assume that a child that wants to go to Garfield High School because they have great programs there.
Stay near your microphone there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. A child that wants to go to Garfield High School or Bellevue High School is necessarily going there because of athletics. And number two, I don't think that they should necessarily be penalized. The school, absolutely. If the school district is in cahoots, like it looks like Bellevue might be, it's all alleged right now, the school district, absolutely, and the school itself. But the students If they're trying to get a better opportunity, whether that's on the football field, the basketball court, or in the science program, the STEM program, good. God bless them. I hope that they get into a better school by whatever means necessary, because it's a hard way to, you know, it's hard to pay for education nowadays.
We're talking about the Bellevue High School football program, the Wolverines, being investigated, and we're going to certainly hear more about this, whether there were recruiting violations, et cetera. And we'll talk more about sports and scholastics in the weeks and months to come on KUOW. More of Week in Review in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review, and Jossie Ross just told me that Prince influenced the vehicle that he drove. You drove a little red Corvette?
I wish I did. You know, he has the greatest line in that song. He said, "Bet I should have known by the way you parked your car sideways
that it wouldn't last."
It's a great line. People don't get that. That's an incredible line. No, she's going to take off right afterwards. But I digress. Yes, I worked paper routes, firework stands in order to get a purple Honda Spree. Moreover, it influenced my dating life, as we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. that my screening process, Prince was so profound. And the movie he made, Under the Cherry Moon, his second movie, was actually better than Purple Rain. And I'm going to expect some boos on this. But Under the Cherry Moon was incredible. But it was either you stood on one side of Under the Cherry Moon or the other. You hated it or you loved it. You didn't have a medium ground like, oh, okay, that was okay, except for the ending. And I used to, when I was in my dating time, when I would go on a date, I would, you know, have the young lady to the house. And part of my screening process was, if they liked Under the Cherry Moon, well, we can vibe. Like, we can get along. You held my worldview. And you probably used the same kind of Tabasco sauce that I used. You know, we seen eye to eye. If you didn't like Under the Cherry Moon, I'm not going to talk dirty about you. But... You know, but I'm not going to write a letter of recommendation for you.
This could be a separate shout out on Twitter, because we're live tweeting at KOW.
So much separate that was quotable.
Separate from Prince, just what is the movie or the pop culture that you made your dates pass through in order to be eligible to go out with you? Could that be a thing at KUOW, live tweeting? Okay.
Very quick derail.
Yeah.
Very quick derail.
Yeah. Ed, the Monkees movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Monkee movie Head, which I'd never even known of. As in, hey, we're the Monkees.
Hey, we're the Monkees.
Okay. Did you have one, Matt, that you feel like?
No, I'm just saying that when you have that show, I don't know when it's going to be, but I'm unavailable that day.
Okay, you're not going to be on that. By the way, I think everybody knows by now that we're talking about this, because Prince was found dead in his home yesterday.
God bless the dead. R.I.P. Prince.
He reportedly had the flu, but it's not. I heard that there's an autopsy coming out. I haven't seen anything about it yet. Let me know if that's different, Bernard. But
can I make one statement real quick, Bill?
Yeah.
Just about this, that sometimes I think, as you know, I'm approaching middle age, and we start to lament things, right? Like, man, I wish I could be this age again, or wish I could do this again. I experienced Prince and Michael Jackson and Madonna in real time. And I wouldn't trade my childhood for anything in the world to be able to experience that as a child and not looking back. Prince was amazing in real time. So I just want to throw that out there. It was an incredible time to grow up in musically.
Here's one question I want to ask of you, because I can't help compare. I've been in my mind comparing Prince and David Bowie, who we also just lost. I had the feeling that Bowie was interesting because he was so seemingly above sexual rigidity. He was kind of blasé about the whole thing. Prince seems obsessed by sex. And so I just want to know, what was he trying to tell us? How did he move the needle on sexuality, if he did? Because that seemed to be, besides partying, pretty much a major theme, and maybe religion.
I mean, as a woman and somebody who grew up also, you know, in the time of Prince, Madonna was my hero. Cyndi Lauper was really my hero. I thought Prince was a really empowering, I mean, just had a very empowering voice about women's sexuality. Yeah. And, you know, and like, I never thought David Bowie was sexy. And we actually talked, I feel like, you know, I feel a little worried that every time I come on the show, you know, a celebrity dies, because we talked about this.
I remember.
With
John Roderick. And
yeah, about David Bowie. Yeah. And he was very, you know, he had this sort of gender fluid above it all thing.
Yeah.
But Prince was sexy. And like, I mean, every man wanted to sleep with him. Every woman wanted to sleep with him.
I'm going to object to that.
Yeah, I want to sleep with him.
Jamie Foxx did a whole routine about that.
You
don't look into his eyes. Don't look into his eyes.
You know, Prince was a feminist. Prince was a feminist.
He launched
women's careers.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
He was amazing. And I think that that's ultimately what he was saying, was he admired the power of the feminine. And that was represented, obviously, with his style and his demeanor, but also with the people who he catapulted. It was almost, I mean, there was Morris Day, there was a few men, but he prompted women to speak for themselves, pass the microphone. I want to speak for myself. And that was a powerful thing about Prince.
But going back to the question, the sexuality question, I mean, as you know, as a confused young girl or whatever, you know, like everybody is, his voice was very much, you know, in favor of women's sexual empowerment. And like, you can enjoy, you know, you aren't like just a passive object. You know, this is giving you permission to like to think differently and to actually talk about sex openly and be giggly about it. And, you know, and think of it as a fun, you know, a fun topic to and thing to explore, which a lot of music, you know, by men in that era is not like that.
And
definitely not now. Yeah.
I'm not leaving you out of this, Matt. I'm not leaving Ellensburg out of this because the other music legend that we just lost is Merle Haggard. Yeah. And I don't know if you're a Merle Haggard fan.
Yeah, everybody's a Merle Haggard fan.
Okay. And you speak country in any case.
Of course.
And you're Republican, so here's what I want to know.
Western, right?
David Bowie and Prince were otherworldly.
Mm-hmm.
Merle Haggard was an outlaw, but he was kind of but he wasn't. He wasn't freaky. Do Republicans, this is what I want to know, do Republicans not like weirdness even in their artists?
I think what it is that Americans love a rebel. I mean, it's part of our culture from the very beginning. And, you know, we may pick our different rebels. But, I mean, if you think about it, what all three of those men had in common, whether it's Merle Haggard from a country western background or David Bowie from a androgynous background or Prince from his background, they were all people who kind of lifted their middle finger to the current norms that said, you know, be damned with the current institutions. And Americans, we love a rebel. We don't all want to be rebellious, but we love to make heroes out of rebels. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's music or politics. I mean, why do you think Bernie and Trump are doing so well? They're kind of a political version of rebels, and, you know, they'll get their 15 minutes. But that's just, I think that's part of American culture, is that we always love a rebel. Now, do Tennessee people pick different rebels than maybe somebody from downtown Minneapolis? Sure. But that's what kind of unites us.
Here's what I don't get, though. The liberals embrace their progressiveness and their rebelliousness, mm-hmm. But you have conservatives loving a rebel who Merle Haggard was a criminal,
was Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Yeah, we love that, you know?
Right. Well, but, you know, he was having sex and pot parties with Willie Nelson. I just like, help me understand, speak conservative to me when it comes
to
artists.
To you.
Help me understand that. That's because I don't get the...
No, I mean,
liberals, I get it.
We tend to rebel against different things. Maybe liberals rebel against social norms, but conservatives rebel against the state, you know, or an oppressive state or something along those lines. So we both rebel. It's just the object by which we're rebelling against that maybe differentiates us.
I think that's a fair, yeah, regulation, right?
Yeah.
Rebel against regulation.
Yeah. And as
rules, right?
As I think I mentioned to you off off air, Bill, you know, Merle Haggard inspired somebody I consider to be a real country music freak, and that's Steve Earle. Merle Haggard was one of his, you know, his main heroes. So, you know, I mean, there's a little. I'm a country music fan, so there's a little freakishness in country music too.
You're an Okie from Muskogee.
I am. Boy, I haven't thought of a good mnemonic, but I'm from Texas and Mississippi, so you know, I'm legit.
The C is for country. That's Erica C. Barnett.
Erica Country Barnett.
The C is for crank.com. Jossie Ross. Attorney, writer, activist. Great to have you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Matt Manweller from the 13th, the Fightin' 13th in Ellensburg, Republican representative. Always great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me over.
We're live tweeting this show. Not treating. We're tweeting the program at KOW. Do we get any pop culture, by the way, before I go? Now, you're still thinking on it. What pop culture does your date have to appreciate before there's a second date? You're listening to The Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in.